Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you back to the Sling the Biscuit podcast, the new Sling the Biscuit podcast. This is going to be episode 21 of the podcast. My friend, my amazing co-host, Mr. Dave Wheeler, is off on holidays this week. He's probably spending some lovely time with his wife, Candace Ray. In to pinch hit for him is my teammate, the guy that I sit beside in the locker room, the most games played in the Fed Zeno, the grizzled vet, fellow Winnipegger, Mr. Ian White. How are you?
I'm good, buddy.
It's good to finally get you on the podcast. I think that I've never, in my entire almost 2 years of podcasting, had somebody that has been so requested to come on the show and to share a conversation with before you.
I'm honored. Yeah, no, it's always fun doing stuff like this.
I think the best story of Whitey that I have to kind of kickstart this conversation off is, I think about maybe like a month ago, we're in Binghamton. And, you know, we just traveled 11 hours. Coach says, you got 15 minutes to get on the ice. We get on the ice. We have our morning skate. Just snap it around real quick, 30 minutes in and out. And we're done practice. And Whitey likes to play rebound. So if you don't know what a rebound is, obviously, one guy shoots. We play to 10. And you play the rebound until it crosses the goal line or the puck goes in. Simple as that. And one of our coaches comes on the ice and says, we're done. You got 5 minutes to be in. And every minute late you are for, like, team lunch, it's a $5 fine. Coach walks away. And Whitey says, boys, don't worry about the fines. Let's just play it out. Let's see how it goes. The most legendary power move. He pulls his helmet off. And that is Ian White, I think, best summed up.
The way I see it, though, is that I don't see him as a coach. I see him as a player. And he's trying to tell us what to do. Hey, we want to stay out there, get a little bit extra. I'm not going to have a teammate come tell me to get off the ice at penalty of paying some money. So you want to stay out there and take a little extra, shoot the biscuit around. That's what you got to do.
Sling the biscuit around.
There you go. Sling the biscuit.
I think the best thing, too, is the when we're going to play the rebound game, every single team has player coaches. Obviously, you know, playing in Columbus, that there's, you know, four player coaches. Every team has player coaches. And you have more rank than anybody else in the league. And you just say, we're not going to pay these fines. We're going to play rebound. Thanks for asking, though. Have a good day. We'll see you in 15 minutes.
It is one of the nice things, though, about hockey is just when you put in the years, you put in the time, you get the respect. There is a hierarchy, obviously. And that's the one thing I found. It doesn't matter what level you're playing at, where in the world you're playing at. If guys have put in the time before you, they get, you know, whatever they want. And if you have, sometimes you've got young guys, well, you always actually have young guys coming in who are pretty green around the edges, and they think they can do whatever they want, and they have to get put in their place a little bit. Even just when I came back to playing last year in Columbus, we have, I was living in a house, similar situation as this, probably five of us in there, and I just turned 38. We've got 20, 21-year-old kids, and they're walking around like they own the place. And it doesn't matter if it's the Federal League or the NHL, but, you know, sometimes these guys need some life lessons, actually, on just respecting elders or people who've come before them, and they need some reminders. This house is a little bit different than what I first experienced down in Columbus. I'd sit these guys down around the table multiple times and inform them on how to load the dishwasher, you know, how to flush the toilets. I actually had to do a full plumb job of the kitchen sink. I think it was 3 weeks in there because guys don't scrape their food off the plates and they just shove everything down the drain. We actually had a full flood in the house that was going through the upstairs all into the garage and stuff.
In this house?
No, in Columbus. And I was just shocked. When I first walked in there, I was just shocked at how I'm not that tidy of a person. But some people live pretty filthy, and you know, we're all adults here, and guys need some life skills. You know, maybe they've never washed dishes in their life, maybe they've never, you know, had to share a toilet with someone else, but just some little respect things. And it's nice that being, you know, having some veteran status, that kids look up to you and they actually listen to you and you know, take your wisdom and your advice for the most part. Sometimes they need a little bit of prodding, but
I think the best two examples just probably happened the last 15 minutes before we started recording. So obviously we're in one of the team living houses. We have two houses on the team and we have five guys living here. And obviously to record the podcast, we need good audio. And I said to Whitey, I said, we got to ask the guys to be, you know, respectful, maybe be a little bit more quieter. I walk into one of the rooms. Hey, we're doing a podcast. Do you mind just being quiet? And he's like, shut up, Trav. And I come back and I says, hey, Whitey, do you mind taking care of it? Hey, we're doing a podcast. Yeah, no problem, Mr. White. No problem. No problem at all. Same podcast he was asking for. Same result. And even like right before we started recording, Whitey says, can we change the cameras around? I want my good side. And I said, yes, Mr. White, we'll switch the cameras around. And here we are. I was supposed to sit in that chair and he was supposed to sit in this chair. But when you have rank and you have veteran status, that's how things go. Even on somebody else's podcast.
Well, one other thing I have to do too. Well, even here, I have to put up post-it notes sometimes. And in Columbus, there's a lot more of them. Above the sink, I actually had a sheet of like a notepad, a sheet of paper taped up there, and it was titled "How to Not Be a R*** Challenge." And this was after the plumbing incident, because I had to like actually like take out all the pipes out, everything. And just like number one is like how to load a dishwasher. Number two is how to scrape your plate off and rinse your plate and then put it in the dishwasher. And even something, we had guys, they wouldn't, like legitimately wouldn't even close the fridge door. They'd take some out of the freezer, leave the freezer door wide open. And it was just, I mean, it was shocking to me that people live like that, but maybe they've never been taught that you have to close the freezer after. Maybe I'll give them that rope. And then so above the, I'll send you a picture after, but yeah, it's how to not be a retard challenge. And then that was week one. Week two on the bottom was like how to lift the toilet seat and how to flush. That was week two. So 1 week at a time, we work on something and see how we can progress. Here, it's just the only thing that's a problem is the thermostat so far.
Well, kind of like the episode of Family Guy where Peter is like, any father knows when you touch the thermostat, and he touches the thermostat and like five dads run in the front. Hey, is my son here? You guys touch the thermostat?
Well, my room's right there. So right outside the where the thermostat is. And I just hear little rabbit feet always hopping up there and up, down. Sometimes they come in here, guys have it set at like 78. Sometimes it's set at 62. It's like, let's just leave it where I set it. And maybe put a sweater on if you're cold.
It's the captain's orders. One thing that I did want to talk about was, so when you came into the team, we'd gone through, like usually every Monday or Tuesday, we make cuts and you know guys get released or guys get picked up. And it's usually along that in the Fedzino. And for about the 2 to 3 weeks before you came in, every week, the guy who sat beside me was sent home. So I'd have two stalls and then I had three stalls. There was one point where I had five stalls in the corner to myself. And then you came in, and I remember somebody mentioned, yeah, we're picking up Ian White. He's going to be coming in on Monday or Tuesday. And I was really excited about the idea of, you know, you're from Winnipeg, kind of just outside of Winnipeg. I'm from Winnipeg. We're both Cancers. We're both born in June. Obviously, I'm 96. You're 84.
I'm a Gemini, but anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I messed that up. I didn't fact check that. Until I did my research. But anyway, I was really excited about the idea of you coming down because I thought we'd have a lot in common. And I've been curious to pick your brain because I remember a year ago when I was in Sweden hearing about, you know, Ian White signs in the Fedzino. I thought, I'm curious why. And, you know, getting to know you over the last month and a bit, it's been really, really fun for me personally. I don't know if it's been pleasurable for you, but I've enjoyed it getting to pick your brain and kind of, you know, seeing your view on hockey and all the other things we've talked about. And I think the best story that you told me was your first NHL contract getting your signing bonus with Toronto. You want to maybe tell that story?
Yeah, well, I was 18. I had been, I played 2 years in Swift Current in the Western Hockey League and got drafted by Toronto as a sixth round pick. And I played in the World Juniors as an 18-year-old that year. And Toronto had five guys who were drafted who played in the World Juniors. The other four of them were 19-year-olds, so it was their year, their signing year. And after the tournament, between January and maybe April, I guess, those four other guys who were 19-year-olds signed contracts. And I still had another couple years of junior, but I was only 18, so usually you don't sign when you're 18. And so after Swift Current, after the season was over, I migrated back to Steinbach, and I was working at Cory Oaks Golf Course as a maintenance man, cutting grass and fixing greens and all that stuff. And I was just riding a John Deere mower. My phone rings and it was my agent. And he said, hey, I got two things to talk about. Number one, he's like, how's the off-season training going? And it was May, and I don't train much to begin with, but I certainly wasn't training in May. And so I was like, oh, it's whatever, I'm working. And he's like, number two, he's like, Toronto wants to sign you. I was like, why the heck are we talking about training? Like, that should be number one. And I didn't really know, I mean, I knew what contracts were, but I didn't really know like the ins and outs of what happens when you sign a contract. And anyway, so I said, well, what does that entail? And he said, so your first deal, your entry level deal is always a 3-year contract. If you play in the NHL, my contract was 500,000 for the first year, 550 for the second year, and then 600 for the third. And they said, and they're offering you a $500,000 signing bonus. And so the wheels were spinning a little bit, so I said, does that mean if I say yes right now that I get $500,000? And he's like, yeah. And so I'm like, all right. So I ended up signing a deal. And when you're working at golf course maintenance, every 2 weeks, like especially at the start of the summer, every 2 weeks you start earlier, half an hour earlier, half an hour earlier. So by that time, I think we're starting at 6, so getting up pretty early. And now that I knew that I was coming into some sizable money, I just went straight to my boss. I said, "Man, I'm giving you my tractor keys. I'm done." So, yeah, I got
You get any pushback from that?
no. I mean, who wouldn't understand that, right? I think I was maybe making, 12 or 13 bucks an hour. Maybe I don't even know if it's that much, but I'm gonna say 12 or 13 bucks an hour, versus the first check I got. Right around my birthday is June 4th, and my first check came in like right around that time, and it was, I think it was about $110,000 American. That was when our dollar was like at 67 cents. So we can't, there's no part-time job that's gonna match that. So enjoyed my summer instead.
Pretty sizable amount of money.
Yeah, life-changing, really.
One of the guys that we didn't tell we were doing a podcast was Brad Rader coming in here for the podcast.
Hey, what's
What's
up,
up, Doug?
boys?
How are you, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. We're just doing
Doing
the
good.
podcast right now. You want to come make a little cameo?
I was gonna go to the gas station real quick.
Okay.
Let's move
We'll see you in a bit. We'll
that.
see you back in 10.
Sorry, man. Just woke up.
That's okay. I was curious, what did you do with the first bit of that money that you got?
So the first check, I walked Steinbach's, known as the Automobile City, and I'd always wanted an Escalade. So they didn't carry that many, or they didn't. They've never actually, Steinbach's, they never had an Escalade for sale there. And they had a white Escalade, which was my dream car at the time. They happened to have one, so I went straight to the dealership and bought an Escalade, and proceeded to blow probably about $20,000 into the interior. I put massive speakers, TVs everywhere. I even had a PlayStation 2 I put in, and I had like a pop-out TV in the dash, and I had so I literally drive my truck and play video games at the same time. It was a very nice vehicle.
That's awesome.
It was nice to have it when, you're 18, ripping around. I just finished high school. I was in high school, just finishing high school. And then I had another year of junior left too. So you're going back to junior and hanging out with all your buddies. And life's a little bit different when you're instead of in junior, I think you get paid probably 100, 150 bucks every 2 weeks or something. And now all of a sudden you've got a little bit of money to be able to live a little bit differently and take care of the boys, and it was lots of fun.
You got the nicest car in the parking lot by far.
Oh yeah.
In Swift Current.
Yeah.
Speaking of taking care of the boys, one thing you got to do is pick up a pair of Sheath underwear from the team at Sheath, which is the presenting sponsor for this podcast, and I'll tell you why. So Sheath underwear is cutting edge. They have introduced the brand new dual pouch. It is a segregated compartment that you put your dick and your balls into, so your ball bag isn't sticking to the side of your legs. So when you get that brand new Escalade and 2002, it might have been 2003, and the AC doesn't work because you blew a gasket, you get a pair of Sheath underwear so it's not sticking to the side of your leg. And the best part about that, on top of that, is that Sheath uses these amazing cooling bamboo mesh materials. So it's comfortable, it's cooling. Your manly parts go into two separate compartments so they physically cannot touch, they cannot stick to the side of your legs, and it's game changing. I promise you will not regret it. You can go to the link in the video description on the YouTube podcast, sheathunderwear.com, and use the code BIZKIT69, BIZKIT 69. If you're on the Apple or the Spotify version, you're in the car, you're going to pull over first, obviously, and safe to do so. And same thing, Sheath Underwear in the podcast notes for code BIZKIT69, which will get you 20% off the best underwear, money can buy. I bet you didn't have a pair of sheath underwear when you got the Escalade, though. Probably could have used a pair.
The air conditioning worked pretty good on it, but that's funny, man.
one place that I was thinking that you actually really could have used a pair of sheath underwear is probably playing in Toronto for the amount of time that you're in there. I know you spent, about five seasons in Toronto. What do you think the best and the worst thing about playing in Toronto was?
You know, I liked everything about it, really. I was 20, so I moved to Toronto, I guess, 2020. Like, the first year pro was in St. John's. There was no NHL that year. I think that was 2004, 2005. And then Toronto's farm team moved to Toronto, too. So no matter what, I was going to be living in Toronto. And, you know, I grew up in a small town at Steinbach. When I grew up there, I think it was maybe like 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 people. Then I moved to Swift Current, which is by far the smallest market in the Canadian Hockey League. There was maybe 16,000 people there. So you go from you know, one small town to another small town. Then I moved to St. John's for maybe 6 months for the season, a little bit bigger, probably about 200,000. Then all of a sudden you move to Toronto, you know, a massive city. It's quite an adjustment in terms of you know, what was good and bad about playing there. They have probably the best support of any hockey team in the world. Anywhere we would go play, there would be a couple thousand fans, Toronto fans, whether you're in Florida or Arizona or even LA. Anywhere you go, there's Maple Leaf fans, and you know, support anywhere. The atmosphere there was great. There's so much support from the city. I mean, there's, along with that comes pressure. And my first year, I think we missed playoffs by, it was 1 point, but it was kind of like half a point. There was I think it was New Jersey and the Islanders. So we were tied for the last playoff spot. And then that was, our last game was on Saturday. Then Sunday, the last game in the league was against, Jersey and Islanders. And I think Jersey had to, one of the teams had to win outright for us to be in playoffs, and if the other team won, we were knocked out, and we ended up, the game ended up going to a shootout, and so we missed by a point. And then the next year was very close too. We were right in it till, I think we went on like a 10, or we went on a crazy winning streak, like won 10 or 12 of the last 14 games, something like that, to try to get in. Didn't get in. And if you, I mean, and success is usually measured it used to be Stanley Cups, but now it's, you know, just getting to playoffs is very difficult. And if you don't make playoffs, especially in Toronto, there's a lot of pressure. But it, to me, pressure is what brings the best out in people. I was young. It was a big adjustment in my life. I have great memories there. The first couple of years that I played there, we had a lot of like legends of the game, if you will. You know, Matt Sundin was the captain. He was one of the, well, he was, and up until, he was the best captain I played for, I would say. Just a super nice guy. I was 21 walking in the dressing room, and you're just kind of, I mean, the way I was brought up through hockey is the kind of hierarchy, whatever the word is. But these guys who've got the veterans, like, you just stay out of their way. You don't bug them. You know, you don't, the older guys, like, you don't talk to them. You just, they let them do their thing. And Matt Sundin go out of his way to say, hey, you know, this is, I'm Matt, introduce yourself, so make you feel home. And I was just some 21-year-old nobody, right? But he was a super nice guy. We had so many, the league was a lot older in those days. But we had lots of great older guys. It was a lot of fun to play. The only downfall I would say, or if anything was negative, is I prefer to be very private. I like living out in the woods, quite frankly, away from all the hustle and bustle. And when you're a Maple Leaf, you can't really go out in public without people recognizing you. So you want to go out for a dinner with your family or with anybody, You know, you've got everywhere you go, people recognize you, so you don't really have privacy. I would say that would be the only downfall. I mean, but it's kind of neat too. I mean, some people thrive off it. They love people coming up and asking for autographs. I don't mind. I don't have a problem with that at all. I feel honored to do it. But sometimes you just want to go out and not be known. So Toronto was a tough market for that.
Are there any ones that stand out in your mind with like fans coming out to bother you in public, whether it be eating dinner or asking for an autograph or recognizing you?
Probably the most shocking I found was actually when I got traded to Calgary. There was four of us, so I think you probably want to talk about that trade anyway. But so we got it was a Sunday, and I had talked to Brian Burke, was the manager of Toronto at the time. And I talked because they brought him in and they were trying to overhaul the team. And I had talked to him. I had a couple good years there. And I had talked to him a week or two prior, and just because he was getting rid of guys. And I just kind of had a conversation with him, like, you plans on trading me? He's like, no, I'll never trade you. I'm like, okay, cool. And so it was, I'm pretty sure it was a Saturday. We always would play Hockey Night Canada Sunday. We'd always play Hockey Night Canada on Saturdays. And so Sunday was a day off. So I'm sitting in my condo and I was eating breakfast, watching some TV. And the phone rang and said Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. And I'm like, oh, it's my day off, man. Don't bug me. So I didn't answer it. And they called back. So I'm like, oh, better take this. So I picked it up and it was Brian Burke. He's like, hey, just so you know, he's like, traded you to Calgary for Dion Phaneuf. And so obviously you're kind of shocked. And then he said, he's like, well, you know, but don't worry. It's like a couple of he's like, I don't know exactly how I worded it, but something to the extent that, you know, your buddy's going with you. So there was a group of us in Toronto, about four of us, well, the guys that got traded, we were the guys who had been in Toronto for the longest, and we were all really good buddies, and we liked to have fun, and we probably got a little bit of a reputation for that. And so after I hang up, I call my best buddy on the team, Matt Stage, and I said, hey man, I'm like, did you get a phone call? He's like, no. I'm like, oh, I'm like, well, I just got dealt. I'm like, I'm kind of thinking you're coming with me. And while I was on the phone with him, Burke called him and told him he was in the package too. So we all, him, Jamal Mayers, and then it was Nicholas, who was also good friends. We all hung out, and Nicholas Hagman. And so that was my first time getting traded. So I'm thinking, all right, I probably have a couple days to hang out, you know. I just had a son pack up and move. Didn't know the logistics of it all. So Calgary calls me right away and said, hey, there's going to be a bird on the tarmac in 5 hours. And so I was like, so I had 5 hours to go pack my life up. I obviously had to go get my gear. So I had to go downtown, pack my gear, get everything out of there, pack my life. And basically, you know, you're saying goodbye to... at some point, your family's gonna come, but you don't know. You're just kind of saying goodbye, and like you're on a plane. So I had 5 hours to get on a plane. We flew to Calgary, and we got there. And so at that time, I still wasn't really like a name in the NHL. I think I maybe played 4 years, but I wasn't like a star or anything. And so we landed in Calgary, and we went out. We were going out to some. It was like some Japanese hibachi place. I can't think of the name right now, but it's like a chain. But anyway, we went out. We started walking down the street, and this was the day of the trade. So, I mean, word would have just gotten out, really. And people, every single place that we went into, I'd go into Shoppers Drug Mart, had to get some. People would recognize me, and I don't particularly think I even have like a recognizable face or anything, but people would come up to you in Shoppers Drug Mart. And then we went out to this place for dinner, and there was tables of people, like actual tables of people coming up and asking for autographs and stuff, which it just really blew my mind, because like I don't even find out about trades that quick, let alone, you know, would recognize if someone got traded that day and happened to be sitting at the same restaurant as me. Maybe I don't even people watch enough, I don't know, but it was surprising. Calgary was out of all the places I played, you get recognized in Calgary the most, quite frankly.
So when you go to Calgary, though, you're going with your four buddies, Hagman, Stajan, and Jamal Mayers?
Yeah.
Or by yourself?
Three of them, yep. Four of us together.
To go back to the Toronto situation for a second, I know we talked about it at dinner tonight before we started recording, but the Vesa Toskola goal, the far-end bomber in Long Island, do you have any memories of that? Or
Yeah, I was there for that. You know, what can you say? I was actually really good friends with Vesa, too. He was one of the guys we hung out with who actually, through a third party, he got traded, I think it was to Anaheim. So the same day that we all got traded to Calgary, he got traded to like Anaheim or San Jose, I think it was. And then they traded him right immediately to Calgary. So he was coming with us. So all of our tight-knit group of guys, we all ended up at the same place. But yeah, we were in Long Island. And I can't remember the score of the game, but it was a pretty tight game. And they just sent just a very innocent, clear, and you could just see, like, he went out to play. You could just see it going from the bench anyway. And I don't know what it is, but those long clears, you're always kind of looking like, is this the one that's going to take the bounce, right? And sure enough, it took a wild bounce, and he just, it was, your heart goes out to your goalie, right? Your heart goes out to a guy, right? Because it's all on you. Bad bounce or not, you're the one that's going to be remembered. You're the one that's in the replay. So I felt bad for him, but it's still funny to witness something like that and not have it happen to you.
Yeah, those ones are tough. Like when they're bouncing like that, you're just trying to get on top of it as much as you can. I remember last year in Sweden, we had one game where a guy dumps the puck in from just outside the blue line on me, and it takes a bounce at the last possible second, and it hits my glove, which is great. But when it hit my glove, I was going one way and the guy was going the other, and he had the wide open net, and obviously that's not
well, and you don't want to like do a full butterfly and you don't want to look like you're too hardcore. You want to kind of play it cool. Like, that's what Tosca is, trying to kind of play it cool, right? But sometimes I guess you got to go down.
was there any reaction from him after that you remember? I know you weren't on the ice for it, but
no, I can't particularly remember. He was, he is a real yeah, he had a very calm demeanor. Like I never seen him snap or like break twigs or something like that. He was a very calm person. Obviously, I'm sure he was embarrassed, but he didn't lose his mind or anything. He was a very chill person.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. So you go from Toronto, Calgary, kind of shuffled around a little bit, Carolina, San Jose, and then you end up in Detroit, and you were the last D partner on record to play with Nick Lidstrom, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And after that, when you finished your last season in Detroit, it was the lockout season, the second lockout year, 12-13. Then what happens? Because I know, myself, I was very curious about this when you came to Motor City and we ended up sitting together in the locker room, and I know a lot of people are curious as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll just quickly go through even from Calgary. So Calgary, I was there, so I finished the year off there. I had arbitration rights that year. They had offered me a 3-year deal or a 4-year deal up to me. And for whatever the money was, it was for $2.5 million a year, 3 or 4 years, I could decide. But I had arbitration rights, and I just had came off like a 13 goal year, and I had a good year. And just with knowing if I went to arbitration, I'd get X amount of dollars, which would have been more than 2.5 a year. Plus, after that, I would have been unrestricted free agent. So decided to go the arbitration route. And right before the arbitration hearing, I met with Daryl Sutter, and I can't remember who the assistant manager was, but anyways, we met with him in the hotel, see if we could hash something out right before going into arbitration. So we ended up agreeing to a 1-year, $3 million deal. And so went there for the season, and I think it was maybe 10 games in, 12 games in, we didn't get off to a very good start, and so the ownership had told the management they got to start unloading some guys, and I was the only defenseman that didn't have a no-trade clause, and so I got shipped out to Carolina. So now it was my second trade within a couple months, and so I go down to Carolina. I'm there. My wife, who had just moved from Toronto to Calgary, and then to Carolina. Now I have a son at the time, a real young son, and my ex-wife was pregnant with another one. So moved all the way now across the continent again to Carolina. And I'm debating, I'm like, do I get settled here? Or, you know, because I just did two moves. But I'm like, nobody gets traded twice in a season. So I'm like, I'll get settled. So rented a nice house and moved everything down there, got all squared away. And then I was there for 3 months and I get the phone call, hey, you're traded to San Jose. So now another massive move all the way across the country again. And my ex was, I think, 8 months pregnant at the time. So we'll go to San Jose, finish the season off there. We went, that was the furthest I actually went in playoffs, went to the conference finals. We had a really good team that year. I finished the season off well again. I had really good playoffs.
I got to ask, with San Jose, you got to have some great Jumbo stories. Jumbo Joe.
It was a little interesting. Like when I first got there, get on the ice, you know, he's a forward, obviously, and being a defenseman, I was paired up with Nick Wallin. And so we go on, you know, go out there for a shift, you know, move the puck around or whatever would happen. We come off the ice and Jumbo would, he'd get off the ice and he'd stand up and like just start screaming at the D. Like, will you guys give me the puck? Just screaming at guys. And I was like, what the heck, man? I'm like, I'm trying. I don't want it. And you just holler at guys. And then everyone has their own way of motivating and whatever. In the locker room, between periods, he'd be howling like at the second line center, like, is your line going to show up tonight? Stuff like that. I'm more of like a calm, you know, chill guy, but he was pretty aggressive. I mean, I was only there for probably, I guess, the last 2 months of the season and playoffs. So at that point, it's really serious, like playoff serious. There wasn't too much joking around stuff. So that's the only memories I have of Joe.
And then JR was in San Jose at the same time or no?
No, he had retired by then.
Okay, so he was gone. So you're done San Jose. And then you end up in a...
Yeah, so then I finished the season off there. I sat down with the manager, you know, your exit meetings for the year. And he said, quote unquote, he's like, you deserve to make a shitload of money. And in hindsight, I should have said, what are you thinking? Because I probably would have taken anything to stay there. I liked it there. I fit in there. The team was, you know, perennial contenders. But anyways, so I go home that summer feeling good. My second child was just born at the end of playoffs. And so I'm now an unrestricted free agent. So July 1st is coming up. And like I said, I had a good season, even though I got traded twice there, it finished off pretty good. And, so I was expecting to, you know, get a couple offers and some decent things to think about. And so the agent I had, he'll remain nameless.
For obvious reasons.
he was one of the guys that took care of the big guys, big name players. But if you weren't a big name guy, I don't even know how he handles them. But there was no communication. I'd never been an unrestricted free agent, never gone to free agency. So I didn't even know how it worked. And I'm not a high maintenance player, but I wanted some information on what we're going to do on July 1st and how it goes. And we really didn't talk. We had like maybe one conversation. It was like, yeah. And this is what really stuck out in my mind. I said, so when I talked to him, I said, what do you do? Like you go around, because you obviously represent other players that are in the same position as me. How do you decide when you call, when you talk to a manager, who you're pushing, who you're like, I just want to know how it worked. He's like, and then he said to me, he's like, yeah, you know, I don't actually go around calling teams on the player's behalf. I wait for them to call me. And it struck me. I was like, man, that's odd. I'm like, that'd be one thing if you're like a superstar, you know, where everyone wants you. But if you're not, you know, you got to sell these players, right? But anyways, so July 1st comes. I'm living in Kenora at the time. And no offers came in. So I'm like, what the heck's going on? And then fortunately on the second, or so what happened was San Jose didn't want me back, but they had traded for, in the summer, they had traded for Brent Burns. So they didn't need me anymore. So they weren't going to resign me. So then I was going to free agency. And so then July 2nd hit, and Detroit called. I obviously wasn't first on their list, but whoever they were looking for didn't pan out on the first. So they put an offer for a two-year deal, X amount of money. And I had no other offers anyway, but I was happy. I'm like, yeah, absolutely, I'll go play in Detroit. So come move here in probably, I guess, you know, August. And we go to camp, and Mike Babcock had me paired up with Lidstrom. So, and obviously Detroit has lots of legends of the game too. We had probably, at that time, at least four guys who had won four Stanley Cups, and a number of other guys who had won multiple Stanley Cups. Guy like really, well, I mean, Hall of Famers. And so you walk in the locker room, it's kind of like, it's a very cool feeling. You walk in there just to be on the same team. And then for the first day of camp, I look at the roster and he's got me paired up with Lidstrom. I'm like, this is gonna be fun. Like, wow, actually probably what's going on in my mind is like, don't screw this up. I had kind of a bit of a history of, you know, shooting myself in the foot. So I'm like, don't screw this up, you know? And so we got paired together, and I'm sure anybody can play with Lidstrom. He's going to make anyone better, but we did sync very well. And we did camp together, and then we played the season together, and we played the entire season together. I missed, I think, five games. I got a broken face, and he missed a couple games. So we probably maybe 72 or so games we played together, and we were tearing it up. A couple weeks ago in the season, I was leading the league in plus minus. He was right behind me, and we were, you know, every shift we're playing against Crosby, Ovechkin, these guys, and shutting them down. And not only are we shutting them down, we're scoring on them, right? So we're having a tremendous year. And for whatever, I probably never really know what happened, but my Mike Babcock didn't like me. I think it was likely the fact that I like to party and have a lot of fun. And so towards the end of the season, there's a little bit of friction there. And at the end of the year, so we had traded for a guy at the deadline to bolster our D for the playoffs. And we had a bunch of injuries all throughout the year. And then a couple weeks to go, finally, all our D were healthy, but now we have one extra, right? So we had a meeting with the D, and he said, it's like, okay, so we're going to, the one guy who was like one of our top D had been out for a couple months, so he needed to get some reps in before the postseason to get in shape. So we had a meeting, and Babcock said, we're going to rotate guys out. So I was about probably fourth on the totem pole. There was Lidstrom, obviously, Cronwall. Erickson was the guy who was hurt, who needed to play, and then Brad Stewart. And so I was the next guy. So we had a bunch of guys obviously under me. So we'd sit one guy out, then another game, the next guy another game, and then the next guy another game. Then it was my turn to sit out. So I think there might have only been three or four games left in the season. So I sat out. And then the next game I got back in, I was no longer paired up with Nick, which was odd because we played the whole season together and we did really well. And anyway, so now we're all of a sudden not playing together, which was clearly Babcock was sticking it to me, but not only that, he was actually harming the team too, because we were the best D pair and we were doing well. And now you're right before playoffs, you're going to just throw that all away. Anyway, we start playoffs, and again, we weren't playing together for the start of playoffs. So
Nashville,
yeah. So the first, we'd start the game. first two periods we wouldn't play together, and then if we'd be losing by a goal or whatever, then the third period we need to generate something, so then he'd pair us together to try to quickly make something up, and it we came up short. But so anyway, I still have one more year in the deal, but now we have labor disagreement the next year. So the players were locked out. Nick decided to retire, and I moved here in August. My kids were in school at the time, so I came back. There's maybe seven or eight of us older players who came here like for the start of the season, the timing, and we just practice and wait until the new collective bargaining agreement was struck. So I was skating actually in Troy. It's only a couple minutes down the road here. And after, this was I think about December now, I came off the ice and there was a bunch of local reporters that would always hang out and try to get some clips from us. And I came off the ice and these reporters, I think there's three of them, they said, "Hey, did you hear that Gary Bettman wants to take a 2-week break in negotiations with the union?" And I thought about it and I said, "Really?" I said, "Honestly, I think he's an idiot." And I said one more sentence, got showered up, went to my truck, sat in my truck for about 5 minutes. I'm like, you know what, that's probably gonna be a pretty big story. So I went back into the rink to talk to the reporters. They're the local reporters that I know. And I said, "Hey, do you guys mind not printing that?" And the one lady, she's like, "Well, you said it." I'm like, "No, I know I said it. I'm not denying that." And I said, "I just don't want to cause any friction between, you know, the union and the players and stuff." Anyways, I didn't even know what Twitter was at the time, but she said, "I already tweeted it out." So I didn't really care. I did think that at the time, and I said it, so I'm like, all right. So I went home. About a 20-minute drive home, I open my laptop when I get home, and I Google Ian White, Gary Bettman, and there was already about 18 headlines that says Ian White calls Bettman an idiot. I was like, that's probably not going to go over too well. So sure enough, get called into the management's Ken Holland's office, and they weren't too happy, obviously. And I mean, should I have said it? Should I not? But anyways, so now I've got Gary Bettman upset at me, and owners upset at me, management not too happy with me, and Mike Babcock, the coach, doesn't like me. So finally, I think it was February 1st or 2nd, the season starts. And now it's contract year. We've only got maybe 2 months of the season or 3 months, whatever it ended up being, for me to prove my case, to get a contract. So I was gung-ho, fired up, ready to play. First game, I got out there, had a really good game, got an assist. Second game, I scored a really nice goal, right? I'm like, man, this is going to be good. It'll be a good year. And then the third game, I was back checking, and the guy, the forward had a step on me. And so I dove kind of right around the hash marks to try to poke check him and plowed into Jimmy Howard. And I took his skate right across my knee, like the front of his skate just kind of stabbed me in the knee and just cut me really bad. And so now I sat out. I was out for I think it was 3 weeks. I couldn't skate, so 3 weeks out of a, you know, 8-week season or something. Anyway, after that, then I got into I got obviously really depressed the whole time. I went to the hospital, or when that happened, I went to the hospital. And I used to drink. I was an alcoholic. I drank a lot. I'd use a lot of drugs. I went to the hospital. They gave me fentanyl. And as soon as I got that fentanyl, it was just like, I mean, it was like euphoria. It makes all your pain go away. Everything was just like, you don't care about anything. And I ended up getting addicted to fentanyl.
And this is for the knee injury.
Yeah. 3 weeks I couldn't play. And then finally, once my knee was good enough to play, I started practicing stuff. But by this time, Babcock, I don't know if he had no plans to put me back in, and I kind of I wasn't in a good headspace at the time either. I mean, I wanted to play, but so he kept scratching me, and I kept drinking and using drugs, and things just kind of, it was 10 o'clock or it was a game day at home. I lived in Birmingham, which is, it takes about 45 minutes to get down to the rink. And so it was game day. We had morning skate, and I woke up. My alarm went off. I woke up probably 8 o'clock, and I had to be on the road by about 8:30. And so every morning I wake up groggy, hungover, and once you're on fentanyl too, you're like super groggy. And so I push myself up on the bed like this, and I turn my alarm off. So I'm like sitting against my headboard. I'm like, okay, I'm awake, you know, like wait till the cobwebs shake off, I'll go to the rink. And then the next thing I know, I look at my phone, it was like 11 o'clock. And so morning skate's at 10:30. So I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm like, I missed practice. And of all the years that I've played, I never once saw a person miss a practice. Like I've seen guys, you rarely see people even late, let alone no show. So I'm like, oh my goodness. So I called the rink. There's no point, because like I said, it's a 45-minute drive. There's no point in even going. Call the rink. Anyways, so I missed a practice. Totally.
And when you call, who did you talk to?
I just called the trainer, equipment guy. But I'm like, is there any point in coming? And he's like, no. So anyways, that was a real bad one. And then, so how it works too with addiction, and alongside, you know, maybe not playing and whatnot, you know, you get down, and then you just keep drinking and doing more, try to feel happy. And we were in Calgary, so I'm still scratch all the time and still hoping to get back in the lineup, obviously. And I mean, you never know where the coach's mindset is or the day that you get back in, right? But you got to stay ready. So we're in Edmonton or Calgary, and I've got one of my best friends lives there. So the day we get in, the day before the game, you know, 3 o'clock or something. So me and my buddy, we go out or meet up with my friend, and we party, or, you know, we're up till about, I don't know, 4 or 5. And I ended up, because we were skating in the morning, and I think on the road you skate at 11:30. And so I wanted to get to sleep. It's probably 5 or 6 in the morning. So I took a bunch of sleeping pills to try to fall asleep. And I guess I took too many, and I missed practice again, to the point where the trainers called the hotel to send security into my room to see like if I was alive. And I guess the story I heard anyway is the security guard was pulling up my, like, check for a pulse. He was like pulling on my leg, trying to wake me up, and he couldn't wake me up. And so he just told the our medical guys, like, yeah, he's awake, but he's unresponsive. So now, missed the second practice totally. So now, my mindset at the time, I guess you still think you might get in, but I'm sure they had written me off at that point. So finished the season up there, go back home in summer, and didn't get any offers. I just kept kind of, so now I probably was always an alcoholic since I started drinking, like when I was, you know, 16, 17, like in hindsight, like we drink every day. And, you know, whether it was smoking marijuana or doing hard drugs, there's always some sort of chemical in your body. And I always had access to it, and I always had money to supply it. So there's just, you get, a problem too was that I was actually very successful in life. So you just kept, it just became a way of life. And even the last full year I played in Detroit, I tried 3 times to, I'm like, you know what, try playing a game where you didn't drink the night before, like, so you're not hungover. So 3 times I tried, I'm like, hey. And the first time I tried that, the next game was I played absolutely terrible. And in my mind, I'm like, well, it can't be. Obviously, alcohol is not a performance-enhancing substance. At that time, I didn't realize, you know, you got to take a couple weeks off of drinking or using drugs to start feeling good again, sometimes even longer. But I took, so then I'm like, okay, well, I'll try it again, you know. So I did the second game. I didn't drink the night before the game. I played terrible. And now it was kind of really like screwing with your mind, like, man, like, it can't be that I have to drink to play good. So I'm like, I'll try one more time. But obviously your career's on the line. You can't just not play good. You're not going to play at all, right? So I did the third game. We were playing in Chicago. I didn't go out the night before. And I was on the ice. Chicago has a crazy, crazy environment there. One of the best places to play. I'm on the power play. I'm on the blue line. I'm dragging the puck across the line backwards. And I just like heel pick and like fall down. And I don't know if it was, it might've been Patrick Kane. Picked up the puck, went down, scored. And I'm just like, and I'm not saying that wouldn't have happened if I was drinking the night before, but anyway, I played a bad game again. So now I'm like, you know what? I can't risk it anymore. I just have to keep drinking and worry about anything else later. So, but anyway, then after fast forward to where I just left off, the summer after my last season in Detroit here, hoping to get a contract somewhere. And by this time, I would imagine that I have a reputation throughout the league of being a party animal and maybe has substance abuse issues. And likely that's the reason I kept getting traded too, looking back on it. So now I'm really depressed and have no prospects. So that summer, I spent the summer in Kenora, and I had a very nice setup there. Just go fishing every day and hang out and do water sports and stuff. And because I didn't have a contract coming up, I didn't train, I didn't do anything. And just drank and enjoyed life at the lake. 3 weeks before training camp opens up, Kevin Sheveldayoff calls me from the Jets and says, hey, do you want to come to camp? And so I almost actually burst out laughing because I was like, man, I can't. If I show up at camp, I haven't been on the ice in like 5 months. I haven't lifted a weight and all I've been doing is drinking and partying. But at the same time, I can't say no because there's an opportunity to play for the Jets. So I said, yeah, I'll come to camp, obviously. So that day I found ice, went skating. The next day, got ice, skated again, and obviously everything's stiff as can be. So I took the third day off and then went to training camp. First day is a fitness test, and for whatever reason, whether it's genetics or whatnot, I can stay in shape pretty easy. So I got through the fitness test actually pretty good. And got on the ice, and I you know, the old fake it till you make it. I was actually not too bad. Got in the first preseason game at home. I played the most out of anyone, played pretty good. But by this time I was like a full blown fentanyl addict. Like all day, every day, like morning to night, you have to have fentanyl. And so they kept me around for 8 days. I don't know if they knew I had a problem, but eventually they released me. And from there, everything really fell apart. I was at Costco. So this is where my legal troubles started. So I have, at the time, I had a gun license, I had a gun permit in Canada. There's different rules and regulations than the US here. But I had 9 guns that I bought in Canada. I got my gun permit when I played for the Leafs. Bought most of my guns when I lived in Toronto. They're all legal, registered. I kept them at my place in Kenora. Then when I played for the Red Wings here, I bought 3 guns off our team security guard, and I ordered an air rifle BB gun on the internet. After the last season, I brought them to my cottage in Kenora. So it was May. So my gun permit was, my birthday is June 4th. My gun permit was expiring. on my birthday that year. So it was May. I was at Costco getting gas, same white Escalade as before. I had a couple jerry cans of gas in the back, and because it's an SUV, it obviously stinks in there with gas. So I had the back window open. I was driving on Waverly. I know we kind of went through the story. I was driving on Waverly.
And for those that don't know, this is in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Yeah, Costco on Keniston. So I got a couple jerry cans in the back. I'm driving. I got the back. I had black tinted out windows. I had the back window open. And so I'm in the right lane. There's two lanes. I turn left. Now I'm on Waverly. So there's a set of lights coming up about a kilometer. And the right lane, there's pylons up to merge people into the left lane. So there's two cars in front of me and two cars in the left lane. So the first car merges, then this car goes, another car merges, another one goes. It's my turn. So because I got the back window open, I can see clearly out the back. I did actually a double shoulder check. I don't normally drive totally by the book, but for whatever reason, And I was on the phone with my ex at the time too. So a double shoulder check, put the blinker on even, and I start leaning over, and the guy that was in the left lane, he puts the gas on to not let me in. And I had a big truck, and I was like, you know, screw you, buddy. So I just kept pulling it anyway. He starts laying on the horn and tailing me and stuff, being a dink. And so I gave him the old, let's pull over. So as soon as the lane opened back up, I pulled over, he pulls over in behind me, and before I could get my truck into park, he's out of his car. And so I could see in the mirror, he was a middle-aged, somewhat heavy-set guy, and I knew I could shit-kick him. But I'm not that type of guy, but I will defend my turf. So he comes up to the window, he is red in the face and clearly distraught. And I said, calm as day, I said, listen, I just want you to know that whatever happens from this moment on, this is all because you're being a prick and you wouldn't let me merge into the lane. I said, that's what this is all about right now. I get out of the vehicle. So we start jawing back and forth. We make our way back to his vehicle. He had a lady in there. I never laid a hand on him. And he said three separate threats. One, he's like, I got a gun with me. Then he said, I'm a cop. Then he said, I'm calling the cops. And after the third one, I said, listen, pal, I know these are all empty threats. I said, you should strap a pair on, deal with the situation like a man would. I said, when you go home later tonight, you'll thank yourself for stepping up for once in your life. And I realized this wasn't going to go anywhere. So the last thing I said to him, I said, you're lucky your wife's here right now, or I'd be smashing your face in the pavement. Go back to my truck, get my truck. And I was still actually on the phone. And so my ex was saying, you know, just, I was planning on driving to Pembina, North Dakota, to buy chewing tobacco. It's about an hour south of Winnipeg. And my ex was saying, well, just, you should go home and cool out, you know, relax. And I was like, I'm fine, nothing happened. And so I get on the highway. I start driving. I'm just outside of Morris, and the RCMP have the highway blockaded and the shotgun's out, and I'm taken by surprise. I'm looking around because it's obviously not for me, and there's no one else on the road, so I have to stop, and they're yelling at the bullhorn, and anyways, they ended up arresting me in the middle of the 75 highway, very aggressively, quite frankly. Kind of smashing me into the pavement, whatnot. Arrest me, wouldn't tell me what's going on. They're tearing my truck apart. And only after they put me in Morris jail and I talked to my attorney did I find out what was going on. What happened was that guy on the side of the road called the cops, said I threatened his life, and I had guns on me. So I didn't have guns on me, but I guess telling someone, you know, smash your face in the pavement is considered a crime. So I got charged for uttering threats. So that was May. So now fast forward to June 4th, my birthday, my gun permit is expiring. So now because I have this uttering threats charge and been accused of driving around threatening people's lives and having guns on me, I have to meet with the chief firearms officer of the RCMP in order to renew my gun license to make sure I'm not going around with guns threatening people. So sat down with her, explained to her, it was a woman, not that that matters, sat down with her and went through the incident, went through my guns that I have at that time. So to have a restricted gun permit for handguns and certain guns, you have to have them registered at a particular address. And when I bought them in Toronto, so they're registered to my Toronto address, I had moved them to my place in Kenora. And I guess technically you're supposed to get approval to do that and re-register them at that address. I never did that. But anyways, at that time I had my cottage in Kenora for 5, 6, 7 years. And I just bought a house in Winnipeg. So I said to her, I said, all my guns are in Kenora. Is that fine? And she said, yes. And obviously it's fine. You can have them wherever you want. So now we fast forward to November. So I didn't end up renewing my license for whatever reason. November 30th, I'm at my house in Winnipeg. My daughter's on my lap watching TV. It was a Friday. And my phone rings and it says Winnipeg Police. I was like, what would they want? And so I answered it and it was Sergeant so-and-so. He says, we're investigating a hit and run with a white Escalade with Ontario plates from last night. And so I was thinking, you know, what was I doing last night? And I was home, so I said, well, it wasn't me for sure. He's like, well, we're 15 minutes away. We're gonna come check for paint transfer. So all right. A couple minutes later, he calls me back, says, okay, we're here, come outside. As soon as I go outside, they put the bracelets on me, put me in the back of the squad car. There's about, I would say 50 police cars there. They even sent the police helicopter there, which in the end was clearly overkill. I don't know what they're thinking or what, you know. So they have a search warrant for my house. And sitting in the back of the police car while they tear my house apart and talking shop with the police officer in the front seat, just talking hockey and whatnot. And after the search warrant, they came out, and the old adage, don't ever speak to policemen. I should have known. But anyway, so the cop who is leading the search says, well, where, comes out, it says, where are all your guns? And I thought it was a dumb question because, like, first of all, I just met with your boss and told him where they were, and you probably knew where they are anyways. And so anyway, all I just said, they're all in my cottage. And because I said that, that gave them probable cause to get a search warrant for my cottage. So they take me to jail on Grant. There's like a new police department on Grant while they're getting a warrant to search my Kenora property. And I lived out in the sticks. And so they got a warrant, I don't know, probably 12 hours after, went straight there. And I had a gun safe there. Most of my guns were in the safe, but I had a 22 in the garage. I shoot birds to eat and stuff too. So I had a 12 gauge at the door. And there was a couple, so maybe 3 or 4 guns weren't in the safe. And most of them were in the safe, but yeah, they have to be locked a certain way, whatnot. And the kicker ended up being too, is that air rifle BB gun, it was a pretty crazy gun, but it was just a BB gun. It shot really fast, but our Canadian gun laws, if your BB gun shoots faster than 495 feet per second, it's considered a firearm. Because I brought it across the border and didn't declare it as a firearm and register it and all that, they charged me with importing guns. So after they did the search in my cottage and got my guns there, they filed 19 charges against me for careless storage, importing guns. I had two of those charges. Those were the biggest ones. Each one of those charges is an automatic 1 to 3 years in jail. So out of the 19 charges, one of the biggest things that really bugged me too was out of the 19 charges, about half of the charges were strictly, the guns were at the wrong address. So since I had, even though I met with the chief firearms officer, the RCMP, and told him my guns are in Kenora, someone in the police office decided they should have been registered at this house I just bought in Winnipeg. And because they weren't there, they slapped me with an extra like 10 charges for just simply guns being at the wrong address. So in all, I was looking at doing 27 years. So I just finished playing the NHL, hoping to, you know, didn't even reach my prime. I was hoping to keep playing. Next thing you know, you're in jail and looking at spending quite literally the rest of your life in prison. So I went to the remand center in Winnipeg, downtown Winnipeg. Is a very traumatic experience. And because half of the charges were in Winnipeg, the other half of the charges were in Kenora, I had to go to Kenora to deal with that part of the charges too. So I went into the Kenora jail, which was, it's a very, very rough jail. And the prosecutor in Kenora, for whatever reason, she had it out for me. She wanted to throw the book at me, and she didn't even want to give me bail. So I had to fight. I spent a couple weeks in jail. I had to fight for bail. Fortunately, a judge agreed to give me bail. But they forced me, part of my bail conditions, they forced me to live at my parents' house in Winnipeg or in Steinbach when I was at the time married with kids in Winnipeg. So, and I had a police enforced curfew. So the police come, I had to be at the house between midnight and 6 every night. And the police would come and check. And so this went on, and the prosecutor's plea bargain or plea offer was 5 years in a maximum security jail. I told my attorney, I said, I don't care how much it costs, how long it takes, I need 0 days. I said, there's no chance I'm going back to jail. I said, if there is any inkling that's going to happen, I said, I'm out of here, I'm leaving, you know. And it took 2.5, almost 3 years of being on house arrest. I had to sell everything I had. Wife left me, and just to pay the attorneys to stay out of jail. And obviously I couldn't travel, I couldn't play hockey or do anything at the time. So this was, I guess, from when I was 31 till maybe 30 till 33 or 31 to 34, somewhere in there. Right in the prime of my hockey career, I was trapped and under these charges. And so that in essence ruined my life. The one good thing that came out of it was when I was in jail, there was no access to drugs or alcohol. And so this was the first time maybe in my life where I didn't have access to it. So I was in jail and I'm in full withdrawal. And I'm like, I didn't even know what withdrawal was. I'm like, what is going on to me? Like, I feel terrible. And it was at that moment when I realized I had addiction issues. So if that didn't happen, I might never have realized it, or it would have been pushed back. But anyways, so when I was sitting in custody, then I was like, man, like, you need to get some help. So while I was on bail, I made a deal with the government that I could go to a treatment center. So I went to this place in British Columbia. I was there for 7 or 8 weeks and got sober. So if there's any good that came out of that, it was giving me my sobriety back. But other than that, it essentially ruined my life, and I'm still trying to pick up the pieces. But I have an opportunity. I've got a way different look on the world, and now's the last few years. It's been trying to put the pieces back together, and I was coaching, doing hockey schools. I have a young son. I was coaching him for 5 years, and then in March 2020, they shut everything down, locked everything down.
Did they? I heard about that recently. I don't know why they did that, but they did. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe somebody in the comment section can let us know. That'd be great.
You missed that?
Yeah. I don't know. Something about a flu, a cold. I don't know. It's news. I'm still trying to catch it. But one question I did have for you. So in this whole endeavor, how much time collectively did you end up spending in jail?
Just a few weeks. Okay. But
everything else was house arrest. Yeah. And I'm assuming there was, or maybe there wasn't any NHL offers in that time to come to camp or whatnot.
No. I didn't. Well, it wasn't even pursuing it, right? I couldn't even travel or nothing, so.
And so you finish that up, you get rid of the charges, you spend the house rest time, you're good to go. Fast forward to, I guess it would have been last season, you're playing hockey again in the Fed Xenal, which is why you and me are here at this table in beautiful Utica Road, Detroit. Well, Fraser, technically speaking, but.
Yeah, well, even the story about starting to play again. Like, I had wanted to play over the past few years, get in shape and see if I could still play or what level I could play at. And so I was coaching, as I mentioned. And then March 2020, they shut everything down, so I couldn't coach, couldn't do hockey schools, any of that stuff. I got into different trades, doing construction. And then it was, I guess, November last year, I got a phone call. So I couldn't, at that time too, I couldn't go into any restaurants. I couldn't go, like, you're segregated from society. Family didn't want to hang out with you. You couldn't go to family gatherings. Couldn't go to funerals. I was living in the South Pembina. And there's two places where they let me go in and eat. There is this miso sushi place, I think it's called Miso, right across from Sobeys, South Pembina. And then there's a Chinese place. I wish I could give them recognition right now. I can't think of the name. But anyways, so I would go in there every day. I'd go in, and it's nice to be able to go in and eat somewhere. So I eat back and forth, Chinese, Japanese. So I'm at the Chinese restaurant, just crushing some black beef and black bean sauce, and my phone rings, and Justin Schmidt, he was calling me on Messenger, and I don't actually recall ever talking to him on the phone before. We had met in Swift Current way back in the day, but he said, "Hey, do you want to play hockey again?" I said, "Yeah, absolutely." So I had an opportunity to go down and play in Columbus,
Georgia, not Columbus, Ohio.
The River Dragons, yeah. In the Federal Hockey League. And I hadn't even heard of the Federal Hockey League before, but I was just happy to get out of Winnipeg, get out of Canada. I know life was fairly normal down in the southern states. So I went to Winnipeg Airport to see if I could fly. Couldn't fly. I stopped at the Via Rail downtown Maine there to see if, or Portage, to see if I could take a train. Couldn't do that, so I'm like, man, I have this opportunity to go play hockey again and just break out of this misery that has been kind of foisted upon humanity with the lockdowns and everything else. But now I can't even get there. So I spent about 3 weeks trying to figure out a plan how to get down there. And finally, after it was December 20th, a good friend of mine who I helped, Brent Stace, he ran Aqua Pizza in Steinbach. It was the best pizza place ever until he lost it due to all the stuff that happened. And anyways, I spent the summer working with him, try to keep his pizza place open. And so now in December, he called me and said, "Hey, I'll give you a ride to Minneapolis to fly down," because I had heard that you could cross the Pembina border and they weren't checking for passports, for medical status,
and those types of things that we can't discuss on YouTube these days.
So we drive. So he says, "I'll give you a ride right now." So I'm like, "Okay, let's do it." So I went and I didn't even know where my hockey equipment was. All I could find was my skates. Grabbed my skates. Grabbed a suitcase, and it was a blizzard out. We drove the hour to the Pembina border. We stop at the Canadian side. He goes in to see what's going to happen to him when he returns. And they said he'd have to do like a 2-week quarantine. So he comes back and he's like, "Man, I can't do that," because he's got a business run. Obviously, I mean, I wouldn't do it either. But anyway, so then I went into the Canadian side to ask them if I can at least go to the American side to see if they'd even let me in, because I didn't even know if I could get into the country. And they said, if you go to the US customs and they don't let you in, then you're gonna have to go spend 2 weeks. So I'm sitting in my buddy's car at the Canadian customs, So, you know, I'll just call the U.S. and see what they say. So I told them my story. And the U.S. Customs agent says, just walk down the highway, come in the car lane, and you'll be good to go. So I'm sitting in my buddy's car, mulling it over for about 5 minutes. And like I said, the snow was going sideways. I'm like, you know, am I really going to do this? Like, just walk down the highway. It's not like the southern border where everyone walks across the Rio and walks into the country and gets hooked up. This nobody crosses the northern border by foot. But anyways, after 5 minutes, I'm like, screw it, let's do it. So I start walking down the highway, going to the car lane. They had admit me into the country.
What's the temperature at this point in time?
It would have been about minus 20 Celsius. It was like full on blizzard conditions. Yeah. And so I get into the country, and for people that don't know, Pembina, North Dakota is very rural. There's no major city there where you have taxis or Uber. So I'm now officially in the U.S., but now I'm stuck at the border. And the customs, they were really nice people. They were like, it's going to be a long night, eh? I was like, yeah, I guess. And so after trying to find out how to get a ride, I probably spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours there. I just asked them, I said, do you guys mind if I hitchhike? I said, nope. So I ended up catching a ride with this young guy. I think he was 26. His goal in life was to drive every mile of interstate in the country. And he just happened to be driving the northern, I think it was the 29 highway, the interstate. And so, and then he was turning around and going back to wherever. Caught a ride with him. Actually, his first time hitchhiking, but it had a neat conversation, meeting a new guy. He drove me to Fargo. I stayed at a hotel there. Played I was so fired up to get into the country, and it's just it's like you're free again. So I was all jacked up. I had a flight at 7 a.m. to fly to Columbus. I knew I wasn't going to sleep. And the overnight guy, I don't know what hotel it was, a little motel. We ended up playing. He was a gay pagan. Never met one before. Maybe met a gay person, but I don't know if I met a pagan. But anyway. We played Uno in the lobby all night, and he was interested to hear or have someone to talk to. I was interested to hear. We actually got along really good, and so stayed up all night playing Uno with this guy. Caught a flight 7 or 8 in the morning to Atlanta. Got picked up and started playing hockey again. Well, actually, well, maybe I'll end it with one funny story. I was sober for about four or so years. And then when the lockdowns happened, like I wasn't even drinking coffee. I wasn't like no chewing tobacco, nothing, super clean. And then the lockdowns happened. And since I couldn't coach and be around my kids, I got a little, you know, I got a little miserable. So I'm like, oh, I'll buy a tin of tobacco. And I'm like, oh, I'll have a coffee. And then eventually I started drinking a little bit, having some beers, and started drinking. And before you know it, I was drinking every day again. And then I went down to Columbus. I had wanted to stop drinking before I started playing again. So I tried to stop for a couple of days, like sweating it out, and I just couldn't do it. So I figured, you know what, get down to Columbus and then worry about quitting drinking again. And so I got down there. And so I got down there on the 21st. So I think it was the 23rd. Me and Justin Schmidt, we went to do stand-up comedy. And I had never done stand-up comedy before. And so I probably had 8 or 10 beers to take the edge off to get up on the stage. So I go up there at 10 o'clock, do my set, get off the stage. And being kind of a veteran alcoholic, I know when I've had too much. So I said to the guys, there's only a couple of us there. So I just got to sit down and just cool out for a bit. So I went and sat down by myself in the bar for about half an hour till everything kind of calmed over. At 11 o'clock, we went to this local hillbilly watering hole that was about half a mile from the hockey house. Turns out, maybe at some other time we'll get into this story. It turns out we think this might be an undercover like hillbilly tranny bar, but that's a total side story. But we go there. There's three of us. I'm walking in, a local hillbilly says, "Hey, you ever have moonshine?" I said, "Nope." "You want some?" "Yep." So go to his truck. He's got a quart jar, you know, this clear liquid, and it was watermelon. And I took a sip, and it was fantastic. Like, it tasted like watermelons. And I was like, oh my goodness. So I ended up actually, obviously you're just supposed to sip this stuff, but I drank about a quarter of the quart jar. And by the time I walked in the bar, I was just floored. And so, being responsible, it's 11:30 at the time, I told my captain, I said, "Hey, take me home. I need to go home." So I went home and thought, I'm like, "Hey, man, this is great." So I went to bed. It was 11:30. I'm in bed. I'm like, no trouble. I've got bad things tend to follow me around. This time I dodged a bullet. Went to bed, you know, sleep it off. It was 1:30. I woke up. So I just moved into the house. Half the light bulbs didn't work. It's 1:30. I had to go to the bathroom. So I get up, walk down the hall, go to the bathroom. And while I'm going to the bathroom, my phone on my bed's ringing, and it was my fiance, now my wife at the time, and she was calling. So I wanted to answer the phone. So I hustle back to the bed, and I trip over my suitcase, and I fall face first onto the night table, smash myself right here, my eyes like hanging down like this, just crime scene blood like crazy. And I don't even, like, we live kind of like in the redneck area. There's nothing around, and not that I would have known any, but I just moved there. I have no idea where anything is. I'm obviously kind of half conscious, one, because of the moonshine, two, because of the head trauma. And so I'm on the phone, I answered the phone, and we talked for a couple hours, I think. And I was just going to sleep it off and deal with the situation in the morning. And I had sent my wife some pictures, and she's like, "That's not going away. Like, you got to deal with that." So I ended up having to call 911 on myself and had to go to the hospital, get my face sewn back together, and pretty hefty bill to get the ambulance to come out to where we were. And then obviously the zippers in the eye.
How much?
Cost me about $2,500, which I didn't have. I actually still haven't paid them. But so then I'm like, you know what? It's just another, like, you can't drink. I can't drink. I've got no moderation skills, all gas pedal, no brakes. So I decided, well, I had already previously decided to stop drinking, but that was the catalyst that says, "That's it, man, you're done." I had 4 good years of not drinking. And so I ended up stopping again, and I guess we're almost up on a year here since I drank again. So
that's awesome. Congratulations.
Thanks, buddy.
It's been fun to do this show. This is like by far the longest podcast I've done in 2+ years. But I think that the people listening will feel the same way about listening to your story that I did, and I think the team did when we had, you know, team lunch the other day at Ruby Tuesdays in Delaware. And I haven't told the story in the podcast, but we're having lunch at, you know, Ruby Tuesdays, and Whitey starts explaining this story. And within about 30 seconds, everybody stopped eating and started paying attention to the story. It was a very captivating story. I think you did an even better job explaining it for this than at Ruby Tuesdays. So thank you to you for coming on the podcast and sharing your story and everything with me. I know that you recently started or wanted to start your own podcast. You want to talk a little bit about that before we cap off?
I was thinking, if anything, I might call it Waves, because I find that everything is connected. Everything, where even our cells work on frequencies. There's just waves all around us, and you throw a stone in a pond, those ripples cause more ripples. So, like we're talking right now, this podcast is going to go out into the ether, and it will cause someone to watch it, and they might tell someone else, and they might tell someone else. Someone might pick up something important from it. Someone might be entertained. The other thing I always do too is if anyone's struggling with addiction, feel free to reach out to me. I've had pretty good success with my own, as well as being able to help other people too. I know that's a big thing, especially in the past 2 years. A lot of people who have addiction problems, they've been exacerbated. So if anyone needs help with either themselves or a family member, feel free to reach out as well.
Absolutely. We go from grizzled vet with 500 NHL games to DM Man of the Year here in the Fed Zeno. dropping off his dishes for the night. He's part of the crew that does clean up after himself. But speaking of cleaning up, that is going to cap this podcast. I'd like to remind everybody that Slinging the Biscuit drops a brand new episode every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern. It's 10 a.m. in Winnipeg, 9 a.m. in Calgary, 8 a.m. on the West Coast. That's Vancouver, San Francisco, Los Angeles. That is also 4 p.m. in Sweden, 3 in the UK, 5 in Finland, and 11 p.m. in China and Australia. To everybody listening, thank you so much, Mr. White. Whitey, thank you so much for joining me. It's been highly requested. I know your roommate in Columbus, Levi, is going to love listening to this. This has been fun sharing a story, and I hope that it's not the last one. Hopefully we can share another one sometime in the new year.
It's a pleasure, buddy.
Awesome. And we'll see everybody next Sunday.